Know the Source on One Radio Network.
Good morning, Real World of Money fans. Time for your weekly fix. Just roll up your arm and we'll shoot it up with some fun, a little history, a little analysis of the world of money with our good friend Andrew Goss, who this is what he does for a living. Well, he buys and sells gold coins for a living. He's a one of those guys. But then what he does on the side is write books and opines about monetary history. His new book is called The Monetary History of the United States, right? And I think it was Steven Spielberg has already bought the film rights to that. So that's good news there, Andrew.
Something I don't know about.
I'm your agent, so don't worry.
Thanks.
I got you covered.
Okay.
I got you covered. No problem. And good morning, Mr. Goss.
Good morning, Mr. Timpone.
What's going on in your life, man?
Oh, more of the same. Just much more of the same.
Much more. New shirt. Clean shirt, right?
Clean shirt, yeah.
Clean shirt.
Mundane business. Sorting pennies, sorting dollars, sorting coins. They're working me to death.
Yeah. Really? That's what they do. That's what they do.
Well, so, coming out of the Philadelphia convention, I had about four briefcases, those pilot kind, you know, filled with coins and things. So that all has to be dealt with.
How long did it take you to get through security? Oh, you were driving.
I drove, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, anytime I drive, I try to take advantage of the shipping opportunity, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Just saw we're Dripping Springs, Texas, the wedding capital of the world. Do you have any more daughters we can marry off down here?
Actually, yes.
Okay,
daughter
well,
number four.
Come on down.
But she's decided she wants to have her wedding at Belfair Plantation in South Carolina.
Well, I'll be darned. South Carolina.
Yeah, pre-Civil War plantation.
Oh, that'll be nice.
With an avenue of oaks that is just, you know how they do that?
Yeah, man.
They plant those, you know, they run a two-mile road out from the main drag.
Sure,
and then plant oak trees on both sides.
Yeah.
And they did that 250 years ago, so
certainly
these things are majestic. It's really an awesome scene.
Mm-hmm. Well, your other daughter got married underneath a huge, remember that huge oak tree?
Yeah, how could I forget?
Just a gigantic oak tree. I think it was, somebody said
springs.
It was 100 and something years old.
Yeah, one of the oldest in Texas,
yeah,
as I understand.
Yeah, just massive, the trunk around that sucker.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a good time, you know.
Oh,
folks,
man,
said
what a
to me,
we had, man.
"Why are you having a wedding in Texas in August? Are you crazy?
Are you crazy? Or
you out of your mind?" But it really was a great party, and I appreciate your attendance and everyone else who made it. Well,
mm-hmm.
thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I don't want to throw out an open invitation, but if you feel like driving up to Belfair Plantation,
be careful there,
Beaufort County, South Carolina.
You could run up your tab, dude.
Yeah, right. I could.
Yeah. Especially if you're going to pay by the drink.
Oh, yeah, but what's one more when you're having a party?
That's right. And when is this little fandango?
December 29th.
Oh, you're kidding? No, like a New Year's Eve almost kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the party will run all weekend, I'm sure.
I'm sure it will. What a guy. Daughter number four.
Daughter number four, yeah.
She does have a Social Security number. So.
Yeah, by now she does. Yeah. But it was her choice to get one.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Well, I've been reading quite a bit about emerging markets, stock markets around the world, currencies, looking at some of the currencies and thinking about the relationship to the dollar.
Mm.
And so I've been kind of thinking here, just let me see if so after the war, WW2 is when the real power of the United States started to emerge.
That's right.
Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair. Well, actually, the emergence of the Federal Reserve in 1913 enabled us to mobilize the credit of the people of the United States without their knowledge, and thereby fund the war in Europe. So
mobilize the credit of the people, and how would that have mobilized my father's credit, who was around having babies at the time in 1940, how would that mobilize his credit?
Well, because any money that he put in the bank on deposit, because remember what we were taught, right? Save your money, pay off your debt early, and live debt-free. And in order to do that, you had to put your money in the bank.
Yeah, you did.
And when you did that, those that ran the banking system, and in the case of 1913, this was a centralized central bank, right? One bank had the monopoly power to issue money. And so what it did with the money once it was issued, Eugene Meyer, the father of Catherine Graham, owner of the Washington Post, was embroiled in a duplicate bond scheme, very well documented, where essentially he issued phony treasury bonds and then monetized them, turned them into money, pledged them as collateral, and said, create me a bunch of money.
So in a less nefarious kind of a way, if what's-his-face wanted to go? Was it Roosevelt wanted to go to war?
No, we're early now. We're Wilson.
Wilson.
1914.
Oh, so you're talking about WW1.
WW1. So you asked me if WW2 kind of set the stage. I argue.
But you think one.
One did it.
The war that end all wars.
Yeah,
good luck with that one.
Yeah, that was a good one.
So then Wilson was able to send the troops wherever they went. I don't even know what happened in World War I.
Well,
where
he
were
sent
they?
The money. It was more important than the troops. It was the money. It was the money. So being able to harness the mobilized credit of the United States. He didn't have to see some, but prior to the Federal Reserve, there was no central bank.
Right.
There was a banking cartel, but they didn't by any means control all the money. And so, you know,
But they were the only ones creating money, right? Because they were putting out loans.
Right.
Okay.
But it was disparate. It was spread around. Yes.
It was spread around. Okay.
And after 1913, specifically in January of 14, it was, in fact, those folks who mobilized the credit of America's savers and sent that to Europe to help them prosecute this war, to end all wars.
But Wilson then could borrow money from the Fed that would create it to buy tanks and soldier
and whatever,
helmets.
Armaments
and stuff like
checkbook,
that.
Checkbook, just here's a check.
Yeah, so that was the same thing that happened for World War II. They were able to do that.
Yeah, right? And curiously, I published that picture on my Facebook page of the first meeting of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
Oh, really?
And it's like a rogues gallery. You know, FDR's father is there.
When was that? Like right after?
Right, 1914.
1914 when they passed it. What was it, Christmas Eve?
December 23rd.
December 23rd, when everybody was
midnight.
Out of town.
Yeah,
but they evidently had a quorum. Or they had
nine senators, that's all it takes.
Nine?
Yeah, in those days.
How many? Do we know how many people voted for this Federal Reserve Act?
I did.
That'd
dig
be a
that
nice,
up.
Nice number to know.
I mean, I'll dig those facts up.
But it only
know.
Took nine?
That's that was a quorum of senators, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what about the House?
Well, they were already done.
What do you mean?
Well, the House had already passed this banking bill, and the Senate was next.
Before Jekyll Island?
This was all after Jekyll Island, Patrick. Jekyll Island was 1910.
Are you kidding?
No.
The dudes went to Jekyll Island to plan this out 3 years earlier.
Exactly.
Wow. How come it took them 3 years to get there?
As Franklin Roosevelt said, nothing happens by accident. Mm-hmm. If it happens, you can bet it was planned that way. So the framework, the beginnings of the Federal Reserve were hatched in 1910 and before. But the one everyone knows about, Jekyll Island meeting there.
The famous one, yeah.
Yeah, where they snuck off on a train from Hoboken. Straight down the coast of the eastern United States to this little island where everyone was on a first-name basis. No one was allowed to use a last name. They brought in staff that was unfamiliar so that, you know, no one could be identified later. If it wasn't for J.S. Forbes, Stephen Forbes' grandfather, Malcolm Forbes' father, we would have never known the story at all. He was just a... He was kind of a gumshoe reporter who fell onto the story and then leveraged it by keeping it secret for many, many years. And that, of course, endeared him to subsequent administrations. Hmm.
So when did Eustace Mullins write the book, The Federal Reserve?
Well, the first edition, as I recall, was 1952.
Oh, so yeah. Well, took a long time before. But his mentor...
Ezra Pound.
Ezra Pound, the fellow that they locked up for being crazy.
Yeah, he was crazy. Yeah, he was crazy, all right.
He knew about it.
He avoided the judicial system altogether when they simply declared him crazy and put him in a mental asylum.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Wow. So...
Must have been crazy, Patrick. He was speaking against the United States.
Well, yeah, yeah. So after the war, prior to the petrol, how did the boys begin to start pushing other countries around like they're doing today? I want to get to this whole
they started
weaponizing
almost,
the dollar. That's
they
going
started
on today.
Almost immediately.
Did they?
What did they do? World War One. They picked a side in the conflict and funded it.
Okay.
Now, you know, there were a lot of pro-German people in those days.
They just picked a side?
Yeah, they picked a side. In the typical fashion, however, those that controlled the banking system actually funded both sides. And so the reparations that were imposed upon the losing side are really what started, sowed the seeds for Adolf Hitler. And the German people were forced to give up, the student land, which is the industrial section of Germany. They had to give it up and all of its production. And then, of course, the banking community was totally undermined, taken over, if you will, by those folks that were forcing it to print currency. So in order to pay its debts... The German central bank was forced to print more and more money so that within 7 years, that's a story of... As they printed the money, those that were in power, and I'm not talking about the elected officials here, the money people, borrowed the money and bought everything Germany had to sell. Houses, estates, factories... Mm. They just printed money and bought things. And
you mean Hitler and his crowd?
No, we're still in 1914.
I'm sorry.
Hitler's beer garden push wasn't until 1924.
Yeah.
You know, after the people had just watched. Imagine if a foreign power took over the Federal Reserve and just started printing dollars. And instead of putting those dollars into circulation traditionally, they borrowed it for themselves and bought everything in sight.
Hmm.
Bought farms and houses and businesses and just bought everything in sight. Within 7 years, the worthlessness of money was historically remembered as a wheelbarrow full of money to buy a loaf of bread.
Right, that classic picture. Yeah.
But by then, the German people knew who they had sold all of their property to.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a secret. And those folks that were connected started to be resented, and this was the rise of Adolf Hitler.
So he was like he came in as a savior.
He did.
He was going to drain the swamp, excuse me.
They put him in jail. They put him in jail.
They put Adolf in jail?
In jail.
Really?
For being a rabble-rouser. And while he was in jail, he wrote that little rag, Mein Kampf. My Dream.
My Dream.
In which he laid out, hey, this is what happened to us. These are the people responsible. Now, you know, to be fair, he kind of placed it on he blamed it on the Jews, right?
Oh, he did.
Right, because that historical... the idea of charging interest,
mm-hmm.
usury,
which is kind of a deep religious kind of thing around the world, really.
Sure,
not just in
prohibited
in
to
Muslims,
every major
right?
yeah. prohibited
right.
to the Muslim religion, yeah. prohibited to the Christian religion. Neither
sure.
a borrower nor a lender be.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Jewish religion, there's no such prohibition. Especially if you're not a Jew. And that's funny, Patrick, but it's true.
No, it's true.
If a Christian won't do any banking or lending money at interest, if a Muslim won't do any lending money at interest, that doesn't leave many people to do it. Who's going to do it? So bankers were typically Jewish.
Because
and as a result,
they didn't have
a prohibition against their religion. Correct.
But wasn't Jesus a Jew, and didn't he throw out the money changers and all that?
Exactly.
But they didn't believe. Okay, go ahead.
Well, he thought of it as more of a moral issue.
Oh, yeah, probably.
It was a moral issue for him. Yeah, but then after that, it became a legal or faith issue. One and the same within the Muslim religion, but certainly the Christians adopted that philosophy.
Sure, sure.
You're not supposed to loan money and charge interest. That has been relaxed somewhat since then, but then that was clearly, anyway, the reason I diverge there is for people to understand a mistake that Eustace Mullins made, and a mistake that's been made many times before, is to paint all people of the Jewish faith with the same brush. How many times have we done that, right?
Of course. Well, we do that all the time with everybody.
Yeah, so all Jews. Yeah, exactly.
With everybody, yeah.
You know, all blacks or all men or all, you know.
All
this,
women, yeah.
Yeah, whatever. This this idea that you know, you're going to paint all the folks with the same brush, that took hold as a result of Mein Kampf. And this is why the idea that, oh, we're going to have to kill all the Jews now or run them out of our country, because the Jews were responsible for the predicament that we, Germany, find ourselves.
They were the bankers.
Oh, yes.
I never made that connection.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Sorry to make it for you.
I'm glad you did. It brings a little more.
Because there is a little bit of truth to the fact that these were the bankers that were doing the deal.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
sure.
They were in charge of printing the money and distributing it and so forth. And did some conspire? I'm sure they did. But again, what Adolf did was he painted all Jews with the same brush. Oh, they're all responsible. All of them have to go. And so that began. And the German people, as I said, knowing who they had sold their property to, watching how this all happened.
And worthless currency.
Exactly.
So they just jumped on board.
Who agreed with them. Oh, yeah, must have been them.
Wow.
And then, of course, World War II followed with Hitler's rise.
Yeah, wow. It's quite an interesting story. Okay, so then after Adolf and the war and the whole thing and...
Adolf took a march. He started walking.
He started going through Russia, right?
But when it came to Austria, they said, hey, come on in. We'd love to have you as our leader. Come on in. Mm-hmm. You know, this is your, we'll just add ourselves to your country. And so he was emboldened, and then he took on Poland. And as the British, who of course had this agreement with the French and everyone else in Europe, so Belgium and so forth, since the end of World War One. They started talking to Hitler and dealing with Hitler, or trying to appease. What do you need to do? What do you need us to do? What can we do? Yeah, basic negotiation. Let's not fight. Let's talk. And they talked and talked and talked. I think this was Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain.
They talked and they talked.
And they talked and, oh, what can we give you and how can we? And the whole time the German army got stronger, took more land, until finally they said, we're going to take Britain too. They had cornered the entire British army, which decided, you know, it was going to go over there and fight the Germans. And they cornered them at Dunkirk. This is the very famous boatilla across the English Channel, you know, private boats that couldn't be targeted and bombed by the Luftwaffe. Came over to the French coast and downloaded all the British army. The entire British army was pinned down at Dunkirk, and without that flotilla, you would have never, that would have been the end of World War II right then and there, because the American people already made it clear, we don't want to get involved. We just keep us out of this. We're not in. And in fact, a great many prominent industrial Americans were on the German side. They didn't even, you know, like, we don't want to get involved. We're actually friends with Germany. Some of our relatives are German. So it was a divided nation when it came to helping the European war, helping in the European war. And it wasn't until the Pearl Harbor debacle that we were drawn in. So in those days, the Axis powers, right, which was Italy, Germany, and Japan, They decided that they were going to stick together and defend each other against the rest of the world. That's essentially how the war boiled down. So post-World War II,
No, that's right.
During the war, the Bank of International Settlements, which had been established during the First World War to handle international payments, particularly reparations, they continued to do business with each other all through the war, and subsequently started to gain control over the banking system of the world. Regardless of whether you were an Axis or an ally, your bank was a member of the Bank of International Settlements, and all of your trade imbalances and surpluses were invested and deficits were paid, etc., all through the BIS, Bank of International Settlements. I think it's who Kennedy referred to as the gnomes of Zurich.
And they were able to monetize debt.
Yes, they were.
So they would create dollars if they loaned a country money, just like the IMF does today.
Correct.
Does the BIS still do that too?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Still around. But
so the boys,
IMF,
and they run the IMF and the BIS, right?
Yes.
The boys. Okay,
yes.
That's the boy. That's the Dollar Inc. people.
Dollar Inc.
Yeah, Dollar Inc. Wow.
So we all got together with our allies. So essentially, we understand that Great Britain was, of course, pinned down on the beaches, and without the aid of the United States, there would be no more Great Britain.
Right.
Now, Churchill seemed to think that they would withdraw to Canada or to Australia, the other dominions, and they would fight from there. Whether they would or not is irrelevant. The island of Great Britain would not be in the hands of Great Britain had the war continued along the path it was following. They were broke, and they had expended the bulk of their wealth attempting to defend their allies, which we weren't even part of. But France and Belgium and so forth were essentially the catalyst that caused the British Army to jump in when they really shouldn't have. They had a very powerful opinion of their ability and their army and their air force, etc. But the Germans just took them apart, man. It was a sadly undermatched fight. And the British were definitely getting crushed. No question about it. Historians have to agree on this. And with, of course, Pearl Harbor, then the tide turned and the American war machine got into the game. And the next thing you know, the Russians are in, and boy, we certainly have a powerful alliance that pushes Germany back and prevents.
Maybe Mayberry writes that the Russians were in before Pearl Harbor.
Yes, they were.
And that Hitler was essentially
more Germans
more
were
out
killed.
Out of oil and gas in the Russian winter.
Right.
He was kind of dead in his tracks when we even got in there.
Yeah, he was trying to make... Well, here's the...
That's what Mayberry writes, anyway.
Yeah, no, Mayberry's not wrong. In fact, it was the Russians who held back the British, the Germans. Mm-hmm. And the Russian army killed more Germans than the Americans ever did. Mm-hmm. So they no doubt were putting up a hell of a fight. Mm-hmm. And the Germans were marching across Russia. I think they were on the gates of Stalingrad there, when Stalin said, "They're not going any further. Now, I don't care. Throw yourself in front of a tank. I don't care. But they are not going any further. They're not moving into this area," and that's what they did.
Of course, Adolf and his team are about 100 today. They're in Argentina having a good time.
That's funny.
Those stories never end, do they?
No, they do not. And
they've actually found some evidence.
Largely because of Operation Paperclip. Yeah, if you want to check this out, Operation Paperclip is your search term. And, go and have a good time. I read the interrogation of the Gestapo chief. I think it was written in, I want to say Anthony Sutton. It was written in the 60s or 70s, but it's a great book if you get a chance to read it. They actually had the chief of the Gestapo, and they spent a great deal of time interrogating him, and he spilled all the beans, more or less, like where everyone went, how it happened, etc. But curiously, during all of this, the Allies now ever confident of victory, because it was only a matter of time at that point. You know, once D-Day happened and we kind of moved on to the ground, then it was clear that the Allies were going to win this conflict. Even though Germany had vowed to fight to the death, they knew that eventually they'd be in Berlin and they would win. And so they had, just as they did in the Iraq War, Dick Cheney called up all the banks and said, "Hey, guys, come on in. Let's discuss how we're going to divvy this up." And I jest, it wasn't Dick Cheney, of course. I think it might have been his grandfather.
Probably.
But anyway, so these guys have a meeting and they decide, okay, so after the war, here's how we're going to do this. We're going to have the gold as the currency of the world. And, of course, the British sent John Maynard Keynes to argue for a supra-international currency that would be managed by a group of people that he and Great Britain would be a part of. And the Americans, with Harry Dexter White, said, "Don't be absurd. Gold is gold is gold. Gold or its equivalent," was the...
that was the deal.
That was the phrase, yeah.
Andrew Goss, Patrick Timpone, and we're going to do a quick little break here, and I want to try to still connect the dots here and just kind of get a better understanding how the likes of, Turkey, Iran, Venezuela, Argentina et al. Got themselves in the predicament they are, and, just kept borrowing money from the IMF and didn't really pack away any gold, but they're beginning to do now. So I'm going to try to understand that, and we're going to ask Andrew about that right after this. Previously with Mr. Livingstream's Wayne Blakely about our Bifido product.
In Americans, we eat food without the yttrium, which is in curcumin. The turmeric plant is grown in India. It's full of yttrium. You take and convert it to curcumin and concentrate it, which is loaded with yttrium. We eat that curcumin, and if you have the right bacteria in your gut, you'll absorb that. You'll actually usually utilize that in your digestion. But if it's not there, then the body will utilize calcium. Get the yttrium out of the curcumin, okay? Mm-hmm. Get the yttrium out of it. You have to have those two bacteria in the lower tract. What I did was I took the two bacteria, pre-digested it, so you've got the product already digested. So that's why it works on everybody. If you don't have those two bacteria in your digestive tract, you can't absorb that stuff. It's not absorbable.
The yttrium.
The yttrium or the curcumin. It cakes up in the lower tract is what happens.
Mm-hmm.
It won't break it down.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I pre-digested it. It's the bacteria in there. It is loaded with bacteria. I mean, there's 90 million per milliliter in there. They're all alive, too. They're not dead like powdered stuff. You know?
Yttrium, who'd have thunk it? Wow, this is a marvelous nutrient that is essential to absorb our nutrients. And it's barely there in American soils. Well, you get it now in Bifido, Living Streams, in our store, the Bifido product, OneRadioNetwork.com. You know, we talked to George Olcott about it. I brought up the yttrium thing and talked to Adam about it yesterday. And he says, George says that it's in the soils. So I was a little incorrect there that I assumed that. But the bacteria to make it go, just like the bacteria in the gut, is not in the soils. And that's why the India turmeric has more bacteria in the soils. For some reason, they haven't bastardized their soils as much as we had, because of, you know, what went on in, you know, the 50s with the NPK and the, you know, the whole globalist agenda taking over the farms, you know, back then in the 50s and 60s when you and I were kids. That's pretty cool, huh? So this Bifido has the bacteria. It's all pre-digested, and it's critical. You can duck-duck-go yttrium and find out some pretty cool stuff about it, and it's like one of those things that are just coming up into our awareness now, saying, wow, who would have thunk it, yttrium? So we're learning a lot, and one of the reasons why we're going to be have a big challenge, our biggest challenge in this world moving forward for you One Radio Network listeners, is how to not outlive your money, because we're learning how to keep around, stick around for a long time if we want to, and you got to have the talent, and that's why we talked to Andy once a week. Previously with Dr. Rulin Chu about her product called Pearlseum. So let's talk about the teeth first. Explain to me what's going on, because there's something magical when you dip your little toothbrush in water. Why do they look so sparkly and just, I don't know, something very energetically about the look of them?
Yeah, it's very, very magical. So like a group of scientists in France discovered that when you put the pearl next to the bones or skins or other connective tissues, and they find it stimulates new growth of the bones and skins and connective tissues, and also to make existing bones and the skins more healthy and stronger. So brush your teeth with the pearl, then your teeth will make your existing teeth stronger, and also it will filling up, you know, teeth with the porcium, and the pearl powder will stimulate the new bone growth and also make the existing teeth very strong.
It's really a great product. You'll love it. Take it internally or on your teeth, and you can click an order, see the ad right there, Pearlseum, the nice green container, Pearlseum, on OneRadioNetwork.com. That would be Usson's. You can go to Mercola. We like Mercola. He's got a lot of good things there, and he's a pretty cool guy, MD and all. And you can go to Mercola and put in something like the benefits of aloe vera. Just put in aloe vera for the gut, and you'll find a lot of different articles from around the world. It's a pretty good place to go and search around. And once you learn more about aloe, you might want to try some of our Stockton Aloe 1. Comes in fresh frozen, two minimum of 2 1/2 gallons. Comes all packaged in styrofoam, and you thaw it out and drink it. And I've been drinking it, three, four, 5 months now. I have lost count of how many half gallons, and I just drink it every day. I think it's a marvelous nutrient, and it's a marvelous plant. Magical. Edgar Cayce was big on it, and he was a pretty sharp character. Stockton Aloe 1, you can look on the right at the top, the front page there. We can have an ad there, and also along the right side. Click an order, get yourself a couple, and experience this product. I think you'll find it quite amazing.
Broadcasting live, weekday mornings, this is listener-supported One Radio Network.
Okay, it's the Real World of Money for September 5th, 2018, with my good friend Andrew Goss, who's a currency historian. His company is SDL Inc., out of Hawthorne, New Jersey, and also Hilton Head. He buys and sells gold coins for a living, numismatic coins. He doesn't do Krugerrands. He doesn't do Mexican silver dollars, even though they are quite beautiful, those Mexican silver dollars.
They really are.
They really are pretty. I saw one at a coin place a couple years ago that I went into, just looked around, and oh my, very, very beautiful. Now, if one wanted to have, say, just junky bullion silver, which you don't sell, that might be a nice thing to have, right?
I mean,
other than a Krugerrand, I'd feel, you know what I'm saying?
Old silver spoons. Old,
yeah, right.
There's a lot of stuff you can buy that's made out of silver.
Yeah. But I mean, but silver spoons, it would be more difficult. Come the revolution, we're all naked in the streets. You'd rather have a Mexican peso.
Well, if you were in the streets of Mexico, yeah, I might agree with that.
Yeah. But even here, though, it'd be easier to do a Mexican peso thing better than a silver spoon, wouldn't it?
Maybe in Texas.
Yeah, I'm thinking it's kind of... Anyway, but you don't sell that kind of stuff.
I do not.
You just do the good old American.
Mint.
Mint issues.
And nothing else.
Where's that name come from, mint?
Yeah, that's a good question.
They call it mint quality. That's a term, right? Mint quality.
Right, it is.
Mint quality.
We'll have to look up the root of that word, mint.
Mint, yeah.
But, you know, when I look at the... at the writings of the Founding Fathers, they referred to a mint.
Did they?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they needed a place to make the nation's coins. That was one of the first things they dealt with way back then. And they constrained our politicians to forbid them or to prevent them from mobilizing credit without the people understanding the risk. And the Federal Reserve System allowed them to mobilize credit without the people understanding the risk, through this idea that the federal government was somehow going to be in charge of this system. Because, you know, prior to the Federal Reserve, just anyone could start a bank, and you deposit your money in the bank, and they lose it. Well, that's too bad. Mm-hmm. You lost your money. And then, of course, everyone else would run to their bank, no matter how good or solvent it was. They'd take their money out. We don't want to lose our money. And next thing you know, you got these bank panics, these crises that were triggered. Some were artificial, some weren't. But the purpose of the first two world wars was to centralize the control of the monetary system to avoid the busts and the booms, and to essentially monopolize the issue of money. That was the purpose of the IMF and the BIS and others.
How is it that the boys were able to form this BIS and IMF just because they won the
security,
quote unquote won the war, right?
I mean, security and cooperation in the model of Alexander Hamilton. So it wasn't like it had never happened before, where all of the folks with a means of production or with some wealth combine their forces and try to take over. I mean, this is not unusual. This is the history of capitalism, or the worship of capital letters, for those who don't know what capitalism is. But, you know, the idea that we would have a central authority issuing our money, that was always intended in our Constitution, as long as we know what the money is. In the case of the United States, it was gold or silver coin. No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender payment of debt. So if you have a central authority that's responsible for weights and the measures and making sure that the coins are pure and that they have the right amount of gold, who would be opposed to that? Everyone would think that's a great idea.
So what leverage did the boys use between World War II and the petrodollar, which was, 71?
Yeah,
okay.
They used
what did they use other the than opposite that we were the winners?
The opposite of reparations.
The opposite of reparations.
Yeah.
Which is...
Hey, we're going to help rebuild your country.
Oh, we're going to rebuild your... But it was just, I mean... But
the Marshall Plan is Exhibit right. 1. Yeah. So they essentially said, yeah, Germany, we wiped you off the map.
Yeah,
but
we're sorry.
Yeah, now we're going to help you rebuild your infrastructure. We're going to restart your business, albeit with our involvement. But we're going to help you. And we're not going to force you to take everything you have and give it to us now to pay for the war that you lost. We're going to do the opposite. We're going to now loan you money. And so the Federal Reserve started with this creating unbacked money because there was so much of it.
Yeah.
And we're going to loan it to Germany. We're going to loan it to German industry. We're going to loan it to Italy. We're even going to loan it to the Japanese.
We're loan it to everybody.
And then this, of course, put them on a path that, well, all
this is where we are today, right?
That's right.
Wow. So these countries, though, were forced to take these unbacked paper dollars.
They weren't forced because the dollar or its equivalent. Now, in 1945, you could have taken a Federal Reserve note into any bank in the United States and received back an equivalent amount of silver coin, silver dollars, if that's what you wanted, until 1933, gold. So, you know, from the founding of the Federal Reserve, the dollar and gold or the dollar and silver were equivalent. And so for the folks of the world, this is just like manna from heaven. The IMF in particular, which didn't start until 44, they get a bunch of contributions from their member states, and then they take that money and loan it to promote the interest of the IMF. So the first is, you know, they kind of forced countries to reveal their assets. You know, they have to open the books to the IMF. Then the IMF says, oh, okay, well then, here, we'll loan you some money so you can buy shoes or whatever dictators like to do.
So that's why in a case like, I guess it's, even Argentina today, they have had, I'll say, 50 years of some pretty rough credit, fulfilling their obligations to the IMF. Right.
Yeah, yeah, I wrote
and
a pretty
now they
decent.
Just, now they and $50 billion they gave them, loaned them just three or four months ago.
Yeah,
because they get them on the hook. It's kind of like heroin.
It's exactly like heroin.
And even though they're lousy debtors, right? They just print $50 billion more and loan it to them.
Correct.
And now they're just
on the hook. You way you put
on
it.
The hook.
Very very
yeah.
well put. So that's.
And let's go through this because this is really kind of interesting, so people can understand how Turkey is in such a fixed today. So they do things in dollars. So say there's a corporation in Turkey and they wanted to borrow $100 million. They would borrow $100 million in...
lira.
In lira from...
Turkish banks.
From Turkish banks. And then they would have to... Say they did this in 6 months ago when mm-hmm. the lira was like 3.79
right
in January. Okay.
Right.
So then they had to take their lira and they... Now they have to buy dollars with the euro. Lira,
unless they're going to use it internally.
Right, but they have to pay back this loan in dollars.
Well, only if they borrowed in dollars.
Oh, they did. And this is the big problem.
That's the big problem. Yeah.
So today, though, they have the lira is 5.79 because the dollar is so strong.
So it takes more of them.
You think? So they ended up paying, according to this thing I read, they ended up paying 54% on this $100 million then, rather than 5%, which was the terms of the loan.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And you know, you're mentioning Turkey, but in the 1990s, Argentina...
Same thing, right?
Well, yeah, they were described by the IMF as a model country because they were doing everything that the IMF ordered them to do. They were privatizing everything, mm-hmm. right? They had the best rail system in South America, privatized. So everything, their phone company, privatized, right? So they...
Who bought it? I mean, people...
Well, who bought it?
Connected to the IMF?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, and people connected to the Federal Reserve.
And you talk about taking over the world, these boys.
I wrote a newsletter back in the 90s entitled "Don't Cry for Me," if you recall that famous play. But you know, this was the history of that one of the greatest republics in the Western Hemisphere, reduced to where it is today by the policies of the International Monetary Fund. It's why the people of Argentina, at least those that understand, they hate the IMF. They hate Citibank. They hate the owners of the Federal Reserve, who essentially use that country as a place to control, like a base.
But it's all possible, Andrew Goss, because the dollar is a reserve currency and people trust it, and right. they don't care where it comes from. Give us dollars, right?
Kind of step one, replace the gold with dollars.
Man.
So replace something we do not control with something that we do.
But I don't understand why countries like Turkey or Argentina over the years, they had to have other options, right?
Yeah, like Bitcoin. You know?
Yeah, but I mean, you know,
it's like,
this is a better
mousetrap. Sure, they did the same options that Germany did. Set up a parallel currency, an internal currency. You know, there are many options.
But then the boys go in there and slam that, right?
That's pretty much it.
Pretty much it.
So they're guided on the path, and if they deviate from that path in any way, well, then they're brought quickly back into line. So the WTO, of course, this is another one.
Mm-hmm.
That is all part of that same cabal. The World Trade Organization regulates trade between countries. So anything that Argentina might have done to boost its internal revenue was quickly shut down by the IMF.
But in the cases, so we have people like Turkey, Venezuela, Argentina, Indonesia.
You could just say all of them.
All of them. You know, the emerging markets are just in Philippines. They have a lot of inflation going on there. You would think that these people somehow would have been smart enough to not keep going down this road.
No,
they're just politicians.
No, I don't.
Because I look at myself
in the late 70s and early 80s, the biggest argument that I would ever get into with someone that understood the banking system and the money system, you know what it was?
What?
That the Federal Reserve banks were privately owned.
Oh, yeah. So
no, Andy, you're full of baloney. They're part of the government. You don't know what you're talking about. You just don't know what you're talking about. So it wasn't until that information got to the public that they understood the pickle they were in. And for the world to see, starting with the Marshall Plan in 1945, the United States was benevolent We were helping. That's what we did. We were allies. We saved the world. We didn't. We weren't interested in lining our own nests. That was not what America was thought to do. It took a good 30 years of blatant looting for the people of the world to finally understand where they were. And, you know, Argentina was no exception. In the 60s, they emulated the United States. They wanted to be the United States.
So months ago, Mr. Mnuchin and Mr. President Trump were talking down the dollar because they like a weak dollar so we could sell more stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now the president of the last couple of months, he's been shoving the dollar's strength down their throat.
Sure.
You know, with tweets.
Using it as a weapon.
Using it as a weapon, especially with Turkey, because they don't like Turkey because of a lot of political reasons, right? And I guess their strategic thing, and they're kind of on the other side of the Iran thing, right? They don't want to support that. So Mr. Trump's enjoying kind of shoving the dollar's strength in their face, and he's doing a pretty good job.
You bet.
I mean, they're not having a good day.
Not without the Fed's help. You know, the Fed has kept the dollar unnaturally strong.
Because of raising interest rates.
Well, yes, right. And reducing the supply of dollars in circulation.
Yeah, they have been tightening. They've
unwound their balance sheet.
Not a lot, but enough to call it tightening, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah, enough to call
enough
it tightening.
To make the dollar stronger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But this is, of course, a policy that can't continue. But while it does, they have the other side on the ropes, so to speak, and are using it like a weapon. Hey, all right, you keep messing with us, and we'll just keep making the dollar stronger, and you'll be unable to pay your bills, and pretty soon you'll just collapse.
So currency notwithstanding, just looking at stock markets around the world, they're all punky. They're all looking very dismal.
Sure.
So is this whole emerging market thing going to be the big gorilla this fall, or... I mean, where do you think this thing is going?
Well,
I
the
mean,
idea
big picture for us here in this country, you know.
Yeah, all summer, the emerging markets, bonds, and currencies have been on a roller coaster, right?
Mm-hmm.
But volatility's good. There's opportunity there, so the investors kind of jumped in and jumped out and moved their money around and really kind of. Well, they eased the pressure because of their flows of capital. But then towards early August, and I think right up until now, as these major events kind of triggered fear, then there was a flight to safety. So folks in Argentina and Turkey converted their money from, you know, Turkish lira and Argentine pesos, or who knows.
$2, right? Yeah.
$2, yeah.
Yeah. So now the dollar is very strong. So right now, because people just want dollars. Iran, for example.
Well, they're scared.
You know, Iran, for example, is doing everything they can to get dollars. They need them.
Sure.
They're actually, I don't know if you saw this, they're actually creating fake Iraqi dinar and putting them into Iraq to try to exchange them for dollars. So
sure.
I mean, you know, they're doing whatever they can.
That's right.
But, I mean, how does a country like Iran get to this point where they're so beholden to dollars?
Well, because
they're
number
everybody
one.
Else?
Yeah,
wow.
Exactly.
Man.
And, they, you know, their number one resource is?
Oil.
Oil
right.
is denominated in?
Oh, dollars.
Dollars.
But they've been selling a lot of it other than dollars, like the Russian.
Well, they're trying.
And China and all
but
of that.
But the world's... The world's market price is based in dollars.
Sure, yeah. So. I mean, you look at the crude price, and that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you'd think that the countries like Iran, theoretically, they hate us, but who knows, you know.
Right.
I mean, you know. You
do
don't,
the people of Iran hate
no,
the people of the United
I
States?
I don't think so.
It's like everybody hates the government, you know,
yeah,
so
sure, yeah.
Maybe we're all in the same boat.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could... CIA went in there and put in what the Shah. Why didn't what?
Oh
what,
no,
the Shah
no,
Iran.
Don't be absurd. I heard CNBC tell me that's absurd.
Really?
That's absurd.
The Shah of Iran wasn't put in by the United States.
No, the
who
CIA.
Did that?
Oh no, it wasn't the CIA.
It was a fair.
No
election.
Reason to distrust our federal institutions.
I would not distrust them. No.
No,
way.
They're operating in the U.S.'s best interest. The CIA.
Mm-hmm.
I mean. the bulk of Americans do not do the sort of research that maybe you and I do.
Mm-hmm.
And besides, it's just propaganda anyway.
Well, you know,
we don't interfere in other people's elections, don't you know? We get outraged
we
when people interfere in ours.
We wouldn't do that because
yeah,
it's
no,
just
no. We
not
believe
right.
in democracy.
It's just not right.
Mm-hmm.
So is it any wonder that even Iran, Turkey, Russia, China, they've been buyers of gold like we've never seen in
no.
the last 6 months, right?
No they, wonder to me.
Yeah, I mean, wasn't it even J.P. Morgan? Didn't he at one time say something like, gold is money? And all else
everything
is credit.
Everything else is credit.
Something
debt.
Like that. Yeah.
It's debt.
Debt or credit.
Everything else is debt.
Everything else is debt.
So if you look at the price of gold.
So they know that.
Absolutely they know that.
Absolutely.
So we're retracing. So silver and gold both bottomed out in late 2015.
Bottom, huh?
Yeah. And there was a difference between the physical price of gold and the digital price of gold. That kind of put in the floor. Because it was hard to deliver actual gold for less than what it cost you to dig it out of the ground. But, oh, you want to buy paper gold or digital gold? We'll sell you that.
That's like, yeah,
right? So gold traded all the way down to $10.50.
In 15? Wow.
In 15. And silver, $13.60.
Wow.
But then a sharp rally developed in the first quarter of 2016. And that led to a 30% jump in COMEX gold and a 50% jump in COMEX silver. So the pendulum swings in both directions. You can't constantly drive down the price of a fixed supply asset while at the same time increasing the supply of what you have replaced gold with, and that is dollars.
So. But gold really isn't though, it's not really fixed supply because they keep digging it out of the ground.
You might as well call it
fixed.
Yeah,
there's just not a lot left.
No, and you know, what comes onto the market is, well, again, it's the
pithy.
Reason.
It's pithy.
Yeah,
it's pithy.
And many are talking about peak gold, but this is really why the forefathers chose gold and silver as the denominator. So no one person would be in control of the money. That's what they wanted. And they provided for the free coinage of silver and gold. If you brought your bulk silver and gold to the mint, they would strike it into gold coins for free and silver as well.
So do you think that these guys like China, Russia, Iran, and these people are looking more towards trying to figure out maybe to compete with the dollar, some kind of a crypto thing that would be based to SDRs or gold
care.
Or something like that.
It's the same scheme.
Of course,
we're going to give
is,
you something
but they
other than
have something, right?
Right.
I mean,
and this is why you ask a question.
What's a Putin going
to
do?
You know why did saying? They turn to the IMF? Huh. Why did they accept the dollar?
No, they had no other thing.
They had no other choice. And are we being herded this way into a digital or cryptocurrency? I don't doubt that.
Who's we? What do you mean? We?
We the people. We the people of every country. They found, the bankers, have found a better mousetrap. And it is one that has more confidence and trust than their currencies. And that's an international cryptocurrency. One that's good in the United States and good in Turkey and good in Japan. And so this, the idea of a one world currency, I can't believe I'm saying this again. It's been 30 years. A one world currency with one central government. Have you watched the Kavanaugh hearings, right?
I have not, no.
This Supreme Court nominee made his opening statement, and he talked about the rule of American law.
Really?
So he made it clear, you put me on the Supreme Court, and I'm not going to be enforcing international law. I'm going to enforce American law, the American rule of law.
Mm.
And this is...
Is that a good thing?
Yeah, it's good as far as I'm concerned,
mm-hmm.
but it might not be good as far as those who would have us with a central bank for the world.
No wonder the global
central,
eye don't like this guy.
They do not like this guy or the guy that appointed him.
Uh-huh.
Because these folks do not believe in this single world government or single world currency. This is like, no, we don't want to do this. But for the folks in charge, that's what they want.
Oh, I see. The global eye they want this single kind of thing.
Single world
and
government.
If they've got to do it crypto and do some kind of magic with that to make
that's
the dollar
right.
Like a reset on the dollar, whatever.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Something well,
like that.
They, yeah. You know, the dollar's outlived its usefulness.
Yeah, yeah.
And now it's going to be replaced
it'd be crypto,
by
crypto. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And just do it on
it'll
your iPhone.
It'll be crypto,
it'll be
and
good.
It's better, and it's good,
safer,
and safer,
stronger.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Just like the paper
so
currency.
So you see that
was.
Coming.
I see it like a yeah. Like an oncoming train. It's like there's no question
no
about
question
it.
No question about it, yeah. Yeah.
The only thing that will rule then will be assets. So as I've always said from the beginning, so I know that I'll always be able to trade my gold or my silver coins for something to eat. But I don't know that I'll always be able to trade my lira or my pesos or my dollar for something to eat. There could easily come a time when each of those units are reduced in value to nothing. It's happened. It's happened before. It can happen again. But gold or silver coin will always have substance and therefore will always be valuable.
So for a guy like you, a hard money guy who's been in the gold and coin business for a long time, all of this has to almost seem like, you don't want to say I told you so, but you did.
I'd rather be doing something else, yeah. Patrick. Huh. To be honest, I'd rather do something else.
What do you mean?
Well, I love writing. I love the movie making business.
Mm-hmm, me too.
I love the production of things.
That's what we're going to do.
Making things, producing things. That's. But how am I supposed to do any of that and make money if I don't know what the hell the money's going to be
well,
worth?
That's true. You know.
It's like I can't go forward. I'm stuck. So until they fix that problem, then my whole being is structured around preserving wealth and doing it in the form of gold and silver coin. I must admit, if there's a flaw in my system, is that I'm hanging my peg, my hat. I'm hanging my hat on the peg. That is the Constitution of the United States. And I firmly believe, and I hope it's true, that all Americans will stand with me in defending and protecting the Constitution. And so it's the safest thing. That's kind of my view.
Well, also, I would suspect, I don't want to put words in your mouth, you're hanging your hat on the idea that you see the big picture like you've taught us, and there's just no way that these people that are playing around with all these currencies and all this stuff are gonna, you know, wake up one day and say, oh, well, you know what?
Andy's right. We're going to gold.
We're going to just get real money because this is not, come on, this is just not going to happen.
No, I don't
I'm the most positive guy in the world, but you know it's not going to happen.
I don't think that's going to happen.
It's not going to happen.
That's right.
I mean, President Trump could get on TV tomorrow and say, I think we should go to a gold standard and I'm going to do it and all. And, you know, he would never get it done.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's just...
Not alive.
There's no way even, you know, if he's going to stay alive, right?
And the People's Bank of China.
Yeah, PBOC, we like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, right. And the Bank of International Settlements
are
managing the dollar price of assets of all commodities, not just... gold and silver, but oil, don't forget, is in the mix.
Sure.
And the idea of free trade, well, that flies in the face. You need regulated, controlled.
Which is why the global eye don't like Mr. Trump, right?
That's right.
Yeah, yeah, because he likes, you know...
Capitalism, free market.
$200 billion more probably popping tomorrow on Chinese goods. You see that?
Sure.
$200 billion, man. He's not playing around with these
No,
guys.
You remember what I said when it was all shaping up in 2015. I said a 25% tariff on Chinese goods across the board.
I know.
Like every single imported Chinese item, 25%. But I was all in favor of doing that for everyone.
Just do it, man.
Yeah. Protect our industry, protect our people, protect the United States. And for too many years, our lawmakers have had this view that, well, we got to help the other countries, you know, we need to help them. And sometimes we have to sacrifice a few of our people and a few of our jobs so that they can advance. I don't believe that at all.
But you don't think they really ever believe that, do you? Don't you think they just say that so they everybody
thinks
they're
nice? Well, listen, I'm trying to... Okay. attaching a pure motive
I'm with
to,
you.
As opposed to just saying, hey, well, they, you know, they got a $250,000 campaign contribution or whatever, and they got paid. Maybe they did. But even, you know, it's hard to believe that patriotic Americans would sell their country out, especially lawmakers. But that is a possibility, Patrick. But assuming that whatever their motives were, this was the logic. This is why we traded 500 banking jobs in Korea for 20,000 auto worker jobs in Detroit. So, like, we'll let you make cars and sell them in the United States with no tariff. You let us come into your financial community and pillage. And that's what we've done around the world, not just in Korea, but for the shoe industry in Argentina and textiles in the Far East. We've sort of decimated American industry one by one in exchange for some dubious gain, most times in the financial industry.
Just another reason why the globalists don't like the president, right?
They hate him.
Yeah, because they
really hate him. Oh. Maybe you're, see, don't like, you know, that's like onions or chili powder, but they hate this president.
They do.
And they would, as I've said, I'll repeat this because maybe it might make more sense now. There are those who would rather burn the nation down than let Mr. Trump succeed at all.
Did you see, I mean, I did see a clip of some protesters.
How could you avoid it? 70 were arrested yesterday.
With the Kavanaugh thing.
In the first five minutes of this
morning.
These people
have no idea what this guy stands for.
They do not.
They just hire him to go out there and yell and scream. Like, what is he going to do to all these lefties that they don't want? I mean, I don't even.
Well, he coordinated. This was all coordinated.
Stupid, you know?
It was admitted on that CNN, CNBC, and other news outlets that the Democrats, led by Chuck Schumer of New York, the senator from Goldman Sachs, got together with all of the leftist groups that he could find and organized this protest. And the senators agreed that they would all keep repeating, "What are we trying to hide?" They would all just keep repeating that. What are we trying to hide? Why are we rushing this process? And then a protester, okay, and then you make sure you protest in the first 5 minutes and you in the second five. I mean, this was a concerted effort to derail these hearings.
I don't even know anything about this Kavanaugh fellow, do you? I mean, do you know anything at all?
I know enough to know he's a strict constitutionalist.
That's kind of good, isn't it?
No, it's, you know, okay. That's all I need to hear. Yeah. So for me, you know, the guy that I think is dangerous is, well, it's a living document. It's organic. There's no way that our founders could have imagined assault rifles. There's no way that they would have thought, oh, there's not enough gold and silver. We can't make gold and silver money. See, they would have never thought of this stuff. So we, the wise minds of today, need to think for them and think what they might have said if they were writing the Constitution today. A very famous case, Heller versus Washington, D.C. Are you familiar with that
one? I'm not.
So for you Second Amendment folks, Heller it was an opinion, a Supreme Court case, in which the plaintiff essentially argued for the individual right to bear arms. Now, do you believe that's what the Second Amendment says? A well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, period. So,
period.
What does that mean? Oh, well, that means that you guys can get together and form a militia, and the militia has a right to have weapons, but the individual has no right to have weapons. See, this is the view, and this is the living Constitution view.
Oh.
And the,
if it's living, it moves and it
moves,
morphs,
it breathes, and
it
changes.
And
yeah. So, as I understand Kavanaugh, he's a strict constitutionalist. So, Congress writes the laws, president signs them, he gets to decide whether they adhere to the Constitution or not, as it's written. Not as we wish it was written, but as it's written. So that's, and he's an independent jurist. So what more could you ask for on the third branch of government?
So do they have the votes to get this guy in?
Yeah, he's in.
Do they got him?
Yeah. Well, it was the Democrats that, you know, eliminated that supermajority thing.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
All you need now is a simple majority. So that's why you have to be careful when you're in charge not to change the rules too much. They never imagined that the other party would ever come into power. You know, that was it. You know, President Obama had the thing all sewn up in the bag, and he was going to use the entire apparatus of the government to help his party win the White House and the House and the Senate.
Emailer sent in this. We were chatting before about the war. Daily Express, I'm not sure where it's from. Big headline, Judea declares war on Germany. Jews of the world unite, boycotting Germany goods and all that stuff.
Well, maybe it's payback time. Because Lord knows the German people gave the Jewish people a well-documented hell of a time. So if they decide that now's the time for revenge...
No, this was March 1933.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that sounds more like it.
Yeah, okay. 1933, yeah.